This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
For those of you who are new and coming to see their friend Ruth, who may not have been to any of our earlier functions, my name is Sandy Forbes, and I'm the Vice President of the Friends of the Museum. And it's my very great pleasure today to introduce to you Ruth Pierce, who's our final speaker for 2013. And we'll sort of see us out with a big bang, I think. Ruth has an amazing career that the details of which I think she might share with us. She had a diverse and challenging international life as an Australian diplomat. She served as, wait for it, Australian ambassador in Honiara, Moscow, with accreditation to 12 former Soviet republics, Manila, and Warsaw. So that's a pretty good list of ambassadorships, I'm sure you'll agree. And when I was Googling her, as we always do, I remembered some of the great adventures she's had, including being, what's the word?
Kidnapped.
Yes. I was looking for another one, but kidnapped when she was in Manila. I think you were roughed up in Honiara too, weren't you? And so adventures abroad in our cause. She's also had senior positions in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and in the now almost defunct AusAid, regrettably, in Canberra, including head of the Americas and Europe divisions, international organizations and the legal division, corporate management division at DFAT, and head of corporate governance and review at AusAid. Phew! So, over to you, Ruth. We're looking forward to hearing what you have to tell us.
Thank you very much, Sandy, and thank you all for the honour of presenting a little bit of my life to you. I do very much appreciate your interest. I've been retired, since February of this year. So I had nearly 40 years of diplomatic life. So I'm going to sort of just give you a general sense of that. From 1974 until 2013, and the big changes that happened in a big macro way in diplomatic life. But the changes, I'll just list them for you so that if I miss any, you can tell me that I've missed it. But just the whole nationalism versus globalism. You know, in 74, globalization didn't exist, really. And that's changed the whole concept of power and influence in the world. And it's still an ongoing sort of transition. And Australia has wonderful advantages in that, and I'm happy to go through that to you. Communications. When I was first posted to Bangladesh, we had a machine operator. And he had his own office tucked away. And we would see him come out with all sorts. And we had to write our reports back to Canberra, and they were sent in a diplomatic bag. I always remember when Barry, our machine operator, came racing out of his office in 75, he said, "Oh, there's a revolution in Canberra." and his friends were on the phone to him telling him what was happening over in Parliament House. So that was an interesting... And then, of course, by mid-80s, only the mid-80s, when I was in Geneva, we got computers. And then now we've got all sorts of things. So that's changed the whole... What do diplomats do? You know, you open your paper, newspaper, or you read on the email before you even know what has happened in the country you're representing. So what do you tell Canberra? Where is the value added? The other issue is the shift of power away from government, official government. And I'm talking about people-to-people diplomacy. Smart power, as Hillary Clinton called it. Get out into the real world. Government-to-government relationships are not as influential as they were before. So a diplomat's life is very challenging, getting out and working out where the real power lies. That was always the case, but it was always generally government-to-government structured. Now, no longer. As Hillary, I was very lucky, my first ambassador, Philip Flood, in Bangladesh, told me on my first day, "Ruth, I don't want to see you in the office." I mean, that was unheard of, frankly. But I was out. He just told me to get out, and I travelled all over Bangladesh in my first posting and got a really strong sense of, you know, what was happening with a whole range of friends and colleagues. But that's the way things have to be more and more, out in the real world, as Hillary Clinton said. And it's changed DFAT's profile in embassies. We were the big kings, queens, kings mainly, in posts, in embassies. But now, often, foreign affairs and trade, foreign affairs, perhaps the old traditional foreign affairs, are a minority in posts, big posts. AusAid in many posts continues to be. Trade, immigration, etc. So, you know, the profile of a government is quite different from when I started out in 74. And then the fourth big change is the socioeconomic revolution, I call it. Oh, sorry, can you hear me? No, yeah. When I joined Foreign Affairs in 1974, it was a male WASPy culture. Male, white, Anglo-Saxon. Protestant, perhaps. I'm exaggerating a bit, but that was essentially the culture. Now we have a much more representative diplomatic presence. More women, not enough yet, but more. I was one of six women in a group of 44 diplomatic graduates in 1974, and I think it was the first year, it was the year of the first intake of the Whitlam government, and I think he was making a really big effort to make diplomacy more representative. And we got six women as a result, probably the biggest group of women for some time. So there we are. They're the big issues that I wanted to... And I should say, too, at the outset, that Australia, I was lucky to represent Australia, mostly. Australia has a wonderful brand overseas. I always remember the American ambassador in Moscow invited me to lunch on my first week to introduce himself. And I went into his salon and he was sitting there and he got up and he came over and he didn't say, "Oh, welcome, Ruth." He said, "You lucky lady." He said, "I'd kill for your brand, Australia." And it's true, in particularly in places like Russia, but remote places, Australia has this amazing image of friendliness, of beaches and sun. And I think we are friendly people. And we deal with other cultures, usually, very openly and warmly. I always remember in Russia when I was there, the big international companies were starting to come to Moscow to open up the PricewaterhouseCoopers and the whatever. And they had so many Australians. And I remember asking one of the big bosses one day at a function, "Why so many Australians?" And he said, "We'd kill for more." He said, Australians are not only hardworking, qualified, but most importantly, you're friendly and open. You don't come to a different culture thinking you know everything. And he said, often too many of us have that attitude. So that's part of, and I'll touch on that later if you're interested. But so I was very, there were exceptions, obviously, particularly in Asia, where white Australia still has a legacy. When I was in the Philippines, I met people who had been to Australia on the Colombo plan, and they loved Australia. It was wonderful, and they were well-placed, very influential. So it was, you know, part of my advocacy target. But they also... Several of them would tell me after a long dinner that they had been subject to racist experiences. It didn't obviously cloud deeply their experience of Australia, but it stood in their minds. And when Pauline Hanson appeared again, you know, I was often asked about Pauline Hanson. So, and I fear too that with asylum seekers, it will be seen as racist in many parts of the world. And so that's the, I don't say only, but as I said, it was a good country to represent mostly. Now, just a little bit about my personal. I think I was 5 years old when I decided to be a diplomat. My grandfather, I used to sit on his knee when I was a tiny little baby. He was in the First World War. And the way he coped with what he experienced was to tell us wonderful stories about the First World War, romantic stories. And here I was as a little girl sitting there waiting for Gramps to tell me more stories. And one of them that I believed until I was about 13 or 14 was that his secret girlfriend, and he'd wait for Grandma to disappear out of there, his secret girlfriend, French girlfriend, her name, we eventually got her name out of him, was Mademoiselle from Armentières. But he really did arouse in me, and I was a little girl on a farm in the Mallee in Victoria. Witchy proof. I don't know if any of you ever heard of it. It's a famous town. It has the smallest mountain in the world. But anyway, my grandfather's experience in the First World War really did charge me up for that. And then I had a wonderful teacher in Witchy, Miss Barrett. We had two classrooms in Witchy proof. Grades 1, 2 and 3, a row for each, and then 4, 5 and 6, a row for each. And Miss Barrett, I was in grade 4 when she came. And if we were good and clever, she just moved us up into the next row. So when I was 15, I matriculated and they wouldn't let me go to uni because of Miss Barrett. And she was a wonderful teacher. And so I went as an American Field Service exchange student to America for a year until I could get into uni. And that really also made me think, I want to have an international career, but I wanted to be Australian-based because I was very proud. I mean, the same in America, Australia, wow. It was, again, the kind of image that Russians had then of sunburnt country and beautiful beaches, etc. But it was a very positive attitude. So anyway, quickly back to 1974, one of six women. One of my first tasks as a diplomatic graduate for the first year was to look after our first ever career woman ambassador, Ruth Dobson. She was appointed as ambassador to Copenhagen, and I had to look after her. She wasn't an easy lady to look after. She was a wonderful, but I had to get all the program and working and organise all the administrative of getting her off to Copenhagen. But that was our first ever career woman diplomat, 1974. I think it was empowered. I think they were realising that they had to do more for young women, particularly in the department. So I came at a good time, I feel. Anyhow, then halfway through our graduate year, we were asked to express interest in a number of postings. And as part of I did a law and political science degree, 2 degrees at Melbourne, I studied Indian studies in the subcontinent. So on the list was India and Bangladesh, and I ticked them both. And anyway, a couple of weeks later, we're in the middle of a lecture, and I get this tap on my shoulder, and it was the head of our postings area, Mr. Thosby Zuch, and he said, "Ruth, I want to see you." So I went out and he said, "Ruth, are you serious?" And I said, "What about Mr. Zuch?" He said, "Bangladesh." And I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "Pack your bags, you're off." And we were all living in Brassey House at the time, the 44 graduates And I went racing back to Brassey, where all my friends were sitting around having a drink after a hard day's work. And I ran into the room and I said, I've been posted. And they all stood up and said, you bitch. Where? Because I was, I think, the first one to be told. And when I said Bangladesh, they just rolled on the floor laughing. But they made a mistake because I had the most wonderful experience. And I was the first of my year to be promoted. And that was because I went to Bangladesh. And I didn't wait in a queue for New York and Paris and London. I went and I was very lucky. I had wonderful colleagues there. As I said, Philip Flood was my ambassador, head of mission, high commissioner. And he was really a very get out into the real world. And he gave me responsibilities. I was there when Sheikh Mujib Rahman was assassinated. And it changed, you know, shifted the whole sort of, Bangladesh was just a three-year-old country when I arrived. And the power game was really quite amazing. I should tell you about my first week in Bangladesh. There was a terrible famine up in the north, and we were giving wheat and food aid. And then there was a terrible debate in our parliament back here about reports that the food aid wasn't getting to where it should be. It was being, you know. So we were told to go down and watch the food being put on the trains and taken up to, and we sat on the train. This is my first week. Train all the way up to the north, and we, for a couple of days, we just watched what was happening on the ground and be seen to be watching. And most of the queues were women and children. And I had sunglasses on. And this older woman, she had about four kids around her. I thought they were her grandchildren. And she kept on walking around me and looking at me. And then suddenly she snatched my sunglasses off me and put them on and walked around like a queen with her children. And we got into a conversation, I think, that really just put another big paradigm around my newly diplomatic career. She told me, I said, how old were her grandchildren? They were her children. She was not 55, 56, 60 as I thought she looked. She was in her early 30s. She had lost about seven children because she'd been married when she was 14, 15. And I was, as you can imagine, just to hear that personally, I was just shattered. Anyway, she then said, and what about you? So she asked me questions through an interpreter. And she said, and how old are you? And I said, 24. And she said, and how many children do you have? And I said, none. I said, I'm just starting my career and I'm not even married. The look on her face. She was in more shock than I was about her. And it really made me appreciate, you know, that so much you take for granted, you have to be always sensitive and aware of different cultures. It's interesting just for me to comment that I only saw one. Bangladesh is a Muslim country, as you would know. It was formerly part of Pakistan. I saw only in my 3 years there, only one woman wearing the burqa. One woman. And she was obviously a very special woman because she was being carried on a special covered carriage by about four men. And she stopped where I was waiting for several hours for a ferry to come. Yes, that's what she did in Bangladesh often, lots of ferries. And she got out and she was completely covered. And I remember the shock of it. And isn't it interesting that she was the only one I ever saw? And I really wonder, I have not, unfortunately, been back to Bangladesh. I hope to go back. I'd be very interested to know if there has been a... as we've seen in some parts of Asia, where most Muslims live, more, what should I call it, extremism. I don't like to use the word, but, yeah, a different kind of Islam. Yes. One never... I didn't walk around in shorts or, you know, I always covered my... But never did I feel I couldn't walk around in Bangladesh. It'd be interesting to know if that's still the case. Sorry, then I went on to Israel... I was in Israel for nearly 4 years. I had 6 months of learning Hebrew or basic Hebrew in a Jewish school in Tel Aviv. I was there at a very interesting time, President Sadat's visit, and, you know, the opening up of the relationship with Egypt. There were many Australian Jews who were going to Israel, but not as many as they wanted. But there was also President Begin was the first, right-wing leader, and he was opening up settlements on the occupied territories. So that, and I remember writing my last report about Israel, I said that really is going to be almost an impossible challenge. And look at it now, it's still almost an impossible challenge. I was responsible for reporting on the political and economic developments of the occupied territories. And I could quite freely drive around. And I got to know lots of Palestinians at the universities, Ramallah and Ramallah, and you know, both ordinary Israelis and ordinary Palestinians wanted peace, and it just has never happened. And about a year after I left Israel, 82, the Intifada started, and you couldn't go anywhere near the occupied territories for quite a long time. So I was there at a hopeful time, but I left in quiet despair. I still remain that way about Israel and the Middle East generally. Then my third mission was to the United Nations in Geneva. I was part of the Australian delegation to the United Nations in Geneva, and a wonderful time. It was the golden age of multilateralism. And Australia was one of the best. We were so admired because we were really committed, active multilateralists. I think we assumed that as a middle power, the UN was just at the heart of our ambitions for the world. And I had a wonderful human rights and refugees was my area of focus. And for 3 months of every year, I would go to the UN General Assembly, stay in downtown Manhattan for 3 months and go to the General Assembly. I was in what they called the Girls Committee, the third committee, which was the softy things like human rights, you know. That was what it was sort of termed in at those times, even though it was the golden age of multilateralism. I also had friends in the mission in Geneva who were dealing with the GATT that then became the WTO, and that inspired me to, I think I was the first of my level in DFAT to go across to the Multilateral Trade Division when Foreign Affairs and Trade joined in 1987. Then I had my first head of mission post, Solomon Islands, as Sandy said. My official title in Solomon Islands, Pigeon, but it was my official title, was Big Fella Mary, Big Fella Girl, Mary means girl, Boss Belong Australia. And that was creative because they'd never had a big fella that was a Mary. So I didn't quite know what to do with that. I thought it was a wonderful title, but when Prince Charles came, I was very envious of his title in Pigeon. He was number one pickaninny, belong Mrs. Queen. Anyway, I think in some ways Solomon Islands was my most challenging post. More challenging, more engaged than Moscow or Philippines or Poland. Because we are the superpower there. I don't mean that's a crude sort of term in a way, but most of the business, everything was sort of Australian-owned, managed, etc., the banks, etc. And, you know, it was a very, very... and it was a big aid program. Development assistance was at the heart of Solomon Islands' future. And I tried very strongly with Canberra to get more and more thoughtful development assistance involved in Solomon Islands. I should tell you that I had a very challenging first year because the Prime Minister refused to acknowledge me because he believed it was a deliberate insult on the part of my government that they would send a Mary, a girl, to Solomon Islands. And I got to know all these wonderful cabinet members, and they said, Ruth, don't get upset, he'll come eventually. And they used to tell me that at cabinet meetings he would say, well, how's my girlfriend? And they didn't dare say which one. They'd say, oh, your girlfriend, Mr. Prime Minister. And he'd say, yes, the one up the road, the one that looks after Australia. That's how he treated me. But eventually he just showed up one event I had at the residence, and that was it. But it was sensitive. Again, I remember, another anecdote, but we were giving a development assistance a wonderful agricultural project in a very remote island of one of many of Solomon Islands islands. And we flew out to this very remote island, and we were waiting for a canoe from the island that we were going to come and get me. And we waited and waited. And we noticed a big, long ceremonial canoe kept on going up and down the island. And eventually one of my colleagues went across and said, who are you looking for? And they said, big fella, boss belong Australia. And they said, there she is. And they went berserk, she. And they charged off, and they apparently had to have a special ceremony to declare me an honorary male before I was allowed to go into the the village. So there again, amazing sort of experiences that you have and that you have to deal with. But it was a wonderful time. It was during the Bougainville War, and our relationship with Papua New Guinea and Solomons, and we had quite a large military presence there. So it was a very challenging and complex and comprehensive relationship with the Solomon Islands. I had the South Pacific Forum had its big heads of government meeting, and I had Paul Keating came along with Gareth Evans and others, but Paul Keating, I told him when he was flying up to Papua New Guinea after the South Pacific Forum to look at this amazing lagoon that we were hoping Canberra would help us get World Heritage Legacy for, and we weren't getting any much interest from Canberra. Anyway, I got a phone call from Mr. Keating the next day from Port Moresby. He said, Ruth, we're going to get that lagoon up into the heritage status, and we did. So it's, again, an interesting example of influence and power. And then from Solomon Islands to Moscow, a big shift, you know. And I was there, I presented my credentials to, not Mr. Gorbachev, my God, Boris Yeltsin, when they could get him to stand up. He was in the last stages of, I won't say it officially, but we had to queue up for months to get to present our credentials in the Kremlin Palace. And I was lucky because my former colleagues were queuing up for 6 months, but I got in just in time, so I didn't have to wait long for my accreditation to be formalised. And I was one of eight ambassadors who presented credentials to Mr. Yeltsin at the Kremlin Palace, and we were spread right across this huge dome. And, of course, I was the only woman, and I had a white suit on, and I stood out because all my male colleagues had very dark, proper suits on. And Mr. Yeltsin was standing up on the platform, and he kept on leaning over to see what was in that white suit. And they had to pull him back because they were frightened he'd fall over. So anyway, eventually they actually had to stop his opening remarks because it was during the war, and he started to get really fired up about it and just wouldn't shut up. So they had to basically stop him. And then we went up individually and presented our credentials, and he was really thrilled to see me in the white suit. And afterwards they brought a big plate of champagne down to toast us, and he came straight to me and said, "I've always wanted to go to Australia." So it's interesting, he wasn't that incapacitated that he associated the white suit with Australia. But then we had Mr. Putin. He arrived within months of my arrival. And we started to notice at formal functions that this little man was strutting around. And it was Vladimir Putin who was suddenly on the stage, and he was up in St. Petersburg. And that was the change in Russia that I had to watch and look at opportunities for. He was very keen to get the economy up and running, and there was lots of interest in our minerals and energy, etc. So we had quite a lot of that focus in Russia. I always remember his first address to the Russian Parliament, the Duma, where he said that Russia's number one challenge, if we're to get out of being basically almost a third world country, was to resist the risk of becoming a raw materials provider to Europe. And unfortunately, I feel like writing a letter to him to remind him of what he said, because Russia has done a lot of that. All these anecdotes. I hope if you get bored, please. But one thing that he did, he tried to resurrect the Academy of Science, which was the Soviet think tank, which Yeltsin and Gorbachev had sort of tossed out the window. But he actually recharged it, gave it a lot of money, appointed a new director. To come back to him, he declared publicly, in 6 months' time, and tell me what the number one challenge facing Russia in the next 20 years will be. Is or will be. I waited a couple of months and I went to call on the new head of the academy. And he said, "Madam Ambassador, I'll tell you in a minute, but sit down, I want to tell you a story." He said, "When I was a graduate at the academy in the early 60s, we were told, our group, to go away for sort of 6 months and do a report using the pure Marxist-Leninist principles, equality, etc., etc. Which country in the world had come closest to delivering them?" And he said, "And which country do you think it was, Madam Ambassador?" It was Australia. In the 60s, when we were fair go, egalitarian, etc., he said, "You were way out there in front of even the Scandinavians. We were there." And this was, of course, I was there in the 90s, and I said, "Well, unfortunately, Mr. President, I don't think we'd come out as number one again." But that was a very interesting example. Again, being a woman in Russia, out of 140 heads of mission ambassadors, there were six women. And we used to meet once a month, we girls, and we'd invite someone. And we became famous. We got phone calls from ministers saying, "When am I going to be invited?" And our male colleagues were really peed off. But it was, you know, you had to be, I guess, as a woman ambassador, knowing that culture where there were very few Russian women in any position of power. You didn't feel intimidated, but you had to be absolutely thoroughly prepared for whatever engagement you had. And it imposed a wonderful demand, in a way, on us. But I always remember I had a new third secretary coming, Gareth, and it was his first week. And I got in to see a minister about something, I can't remember what. Anyway, we went along to the minister's office and we were sitting outside, and this is Gareth's first official function. He was there to take notes and write a report on it for me. Anyway, we waited for a few minutes, and then door bursts open. Out of the door comes the minister, and he goes across to Gareth and he says, "Welcome, Ambassador." So that's just an example of the culture. No. Now, what else did I want? Then, of course, after, and I travelled around the former Soviet republics. I was ambassador to Moldova and Kazakhstan and Armenia. Amazing, amazing. We didn't have a lot of substance to most of the relationships. I mean, Kazakhstan was different because there was minerals and there were Australian companies that were interested in investing there. But I had incredible experiences just touching base with the Uzbekistans. And I'll tell you another funny story. When I was being presented to the president of Moldova, I was told to come a day earlier because there was a very traditional medieval ceremony for presenting credentials. They would send a carriage to your hotel, and it was all horses, and they would come and bring you to the palace. And then they would step out the welcoming, and they would shout a welcome to you, and you had to learn to shout back in Moldovan. So I spent a day at the protocol office of the foreign ministry learning what to shout. Anyway, we get there, and they had this amazing golden steps up to where the president was waiting, and medieval guard of honour were all along the guard, and they were like that. And the head of the guard of honour stepped out and he said, "Welcome, Ambassador of Austria." And he unfortunately realised what he'd said and he just fell apart. And his colleagues were waiting for the next order so that they could guide me up to the the steps, and in the end they had to step out and get him so that I could get up the steps. So that was a very interesting introduction to Moldova. And when I came down the steps after meeting with the president, an excellent meeting, I looked up and saw the flags there, the Moldovan flag and the Aussie flag with red stars. So when I got back to Moscow, I called my Austrian colleague and I called my New Zealand colleagues and I said, "You don't need to present credentials in Moldova." But that's just wonderful. But it was, as I said, we had an office in Vladivostok because we were very interested in Russia's attitude to its Asia, its part of Asia. And the only personal encounter I had with President Putin was I went to a speech he gave where he declared Russia was the only Eurasian country in the world. And I actually went up to him afterwards and introduced myself as the representative of the other Eurasian country in the world. But we were interested in what they were planning to do and their relationship with China and the rest of Asia and Central Asia as well. At that stage, they were still very, very focused on Europe, but I think less and less so now is the future. Anyway, so finally to the Philippines, that was probably, again, one of more influential, Australia's standing, Philippines as a Southeast Asian, ASEAN colleague. We had a lot of Australians doing business in the Philippines. We've had a wonderful aid program in the Philippines for years. A wonderful example of how well Australia does its aid, generally, out in the field, in the communities. Wonderful education projects, investing in the future. And I was really very proud of... And then after the Bali bombings, when we saw what was happening down in the south of the Philippines, Mindanao, with its Muslim population that had been infiltrated by religious people from Afghanistan, Pakistan. We've always been in Mindanao because it was one of the poorest areas, but we then started focusing more thoughtfully about how we address those issues. It was interesting, again, going back to another anecdote, I got to know through that program a woman who was a member of the Parliament, Congress of the Philippines, and she was very influential. She was one of the aristocracy of Mindanao. And I worked with her closely with my AusAid colleagues. And I remember we went down to open this particular school for young girls, Muslim girls, and she invited me to her residence to meet her mother before we went to the ceremony. And we sat down and she had photographs of all her ancestors and family and grandmothers and whatever around her. And she said, "Ruth, what do you notice about my family and my mother and me?" Of course, I knew not one of them ever wore a veil. Never. Never, never. Then after the lunch, I went to the school and these four or five little girls came out to greet me, veiled. Not burqa, but veiled, which is, again, a very interesting development for the Philippines. Australia, we were called the deputy sheriff by our prime minister, and that did cause problems. The Americans have always had a strong presence in the Philippines, but it became more and more complex. But we were then called the deputy sheriff. And that's why I think in many ways our embassy was targeted to be blown up. And the Philippine security discovered this, I think, and they brought us in and said, "We've got reports that say that there are a group of people coming up from Mindanao in the south on a boat and they're going to blow your embassy up." And we had noticed that a couple of young men for a couple of days had been walking around. We were in a public building, a shared building. We were on the third, fourth floors, I think. And when we finally got, our security people decided to get the local security to come and ask them what they were doing, they ran off down the road and we never discovered it. But that determined that we were going to shut the embassy. It was just too high a risk. And we closed our embassy and we operated from my residence for a couple of weeks and the residence of other colleagues. And then a huge, massive effort to get us into a much more secure building. And it changed our whole profile. And from then on, I had 24-hour bodyguards around the house, wherever I went, until I got a BMW, a bomb-proof BMW sent, I had a car of security in front of me and behind me, blaring and flashing their lights. Didn't make you feel very safe. But so that was the context in which I operated there. And then the kidnapping. I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, I think. It's still not clear. But there was big renovations going on at the residence and I was put into a studio apartment right in the heart of Manila. And that apartment was traditionally where a lot of the previous military coups happened. And this was a military coup attempt. And I happened to be in there, although they do say that they'd been monitoring the place and they knew that I was there, and I think they thought having an ambassador there would attract support, not support, but force the government to basically do what they were being told to do, resign. And instead the government of Mrs. Gloria Macca Bagal Arroyo declared that if they didn't basically surrender by 5 o'clock, the whole place would be blown up with me and my goddaughter inside. So it was very interesting. I just had John Howard visited officially a couple of weeks before, and he was on the phone to me. This is weird, isn't it? You're mobile, you're new communications, every couple of hours to see how I was tracking inside being kidnapped. But anyway, eventually they tried to get me out alone and I said no, because we had a group of Australian policemen who were up there doing some assistance to the local police. And I said, well, I can't walk out and be saved and have the possibility of Australian police force blown up. So I didn't, and eventually they backed off. I had the American ambassador call me, Frank, and he said, "Ruth, you've just ruined my holiday." He'd had to come back, and but he told me that, in fact, Mr. Bush was phoning the president to tell her that she had to back off. So it was a very interesting, intriguing time. And I had my several military attachés sitting down on the street below the big high-rise apartments that I was sort of waving at me to reassure me that things were going to be okay. So that was just another example of... and another funny thing happened. They called me and said, "Mrs. Ambassador, we're coming up to get you. Open the door and we'll take you down and then you're out." So up they came and I went out with my goddaughter. We're walking down the open area and the ground level where all the now detained soldiers were. And they all stood up and saluted me. And then when I walked out the door, all the media, thousands of them, were across the street and they started running across and there were screams and shouts because the whole of the front area of the hotel had been laid with explosives. And they had to push them back and I was surrounded by bodyguards and they actually picked me up and threw me into a bush. No, not George W. So it's an interesting... but the Philippines, as I said, was a very, very challenging and wonderful, wonderful people, the Philippines. They are really amazing people. So what else do I want to tell you? I think that's... And then I Poland. I chose... Can I tell you, I have chosen every single one of my posts, and that's exceptional. But you can see... I mean, apart from Geneva, most of them were not conventional favourites. And I really felt sad for all my colleagues that didn't see the inspiration of going to places that were very different. I was told, I don't mean to be offensive, Sandy, but I was told to express interest in Ottawa as my last post.
I'm glad you did.
And I thought, it's a special relationship, but I want something different. For my last post, I would have loved to have gone back to Bangladesh, quite frankly, but it wasn't available. India was the only post I didn't have that I would have loved to have had. But anyway, so I chose Poland, again for many reasons. I was particularly seeing from a Soviet Russia. Poland was the least Sovietized of all the Soviet sort of spheres of influence. They were defiant. In many ways. And it was a combination of their own history, you know, terrible history, being in the heart of Europe and sort of raped and pillaged north, south, east, west. And so they kept their sort of tenacity and their defiance quietly. And I think the Catholic Church also empowered them, particularly when Pope John Paul spread the word, and that was very strong. I was also interested in Poland because it was the... Oh, and it was interesting to compare Poland, its history. Tyranny of distance. I would always start all my speeches by saying Australia's biggest challenge has been the tyranny of distance. And am I spending too much time? I'll finish soon. Yeah. I'll finish soon. Is that all right? No? Okay. the tyranny of distance, that Australia has always had to reach out. And, you know, in my generation, you didn't do anything until you... reached out and went by bus until after Afghanistan shut down, all the way to Europe, and you know, lived and worked there. Australia always had, we had to, that was our life. And that's why I think we're good global citizens, because we're used to reaching out. Poland, its biggest challenge was being too close to everything, the heart of Europe. So it was interesting to see the difference. And it was also just become a member of the EU. And we branded it the biggest new EU member. And we got a lot of interest. Macquarie invested very strongly in Poland. So we were getting interest. So that was a very interesting time. And I was also interested because I have a strong interest since I was a little girl, again, read a book about the Holocaust. And that was one of the reasons I chose to apply for Israel. Poland as well in the background. Poland was really the heart of the Jewish European civilization. And it was, and as you would know, Hitler set up most of the concentration camps in Poland. So that was a very interesting part of Poland's amazing history. And again, the Polish people, wonderful people, friendly, open, I think because of their history, not introverted, and it was a very special posting. And I was responsible also for the Czech Republic, so I could go on holidays to Prague every 6 weeks. I don't know any of you have been to Prague, but it's a beautiful country. And we have an office in Prague, but not an embassy. We shut down our embassy many years before. So that was it. So there we are. I mean, I haven't touched on my life. The most important part of diplomacy in many ways is back here in Canberra. This is where the power is. I think too much of it. But this is where decisions are made. And when you're the head of a division, I was the head of the Europe and Americas division, legal division, etc., you do have more direct contact with ministers, etc. So it was wonderful to be in that part. Foreign affairs traditionally hasn't sort of been a good Commonwealth public service servant. Don't mix and get out enough. And it was interesting when I was the head of our corporate management division, it was when John Howard came into power and started revolutionising the public service. And I thought, oh, I should get out and see what other public departments are doing in the Commonwealth. And often many of them said, this is the first time we've ever met a foreign affairs person. So that's always the challenge of foreign affairs. You spend half your life overseas and then you come back. For families, that's especially challenging, for bringing up children. And it does tend to put a lot of people hesitate about applying for foreign affairs because of the effect on families. When I was part of corporate management division, we had a counsellor and support for situations. But there wasn't a week went by when there wasn't a complication at a post to do with families, the pressures of family, and having children away and, you know, difficult. I want to show you, this is a book, Wife and Baggage to Follow. This has just been launched by Rachel Miller, the wife of an ambassador, a loyal colleague. And this is what real life was about then. When I started, it hadn't been too long before where your assessment as a diplomat depended on too the role of your wife. And if she wasn't a good girl, you didn't get the best assessment. So, you know, it's been difficult. And that was back, you know, in the times when, as I said, the great majority of diplomats were men. So it's always been a big challenge to keep a dynamic culture alive and well in foreign affairs and trade. So thank you very much for your attention.
I hate to interrupt the applause. On your behalf, may I thank Ruth for a fantastically interesting talk today, a world tour, and definitely a landmark woman. And it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you. And I'll say, as somebody who had to live in Ottawa for 26 years, you were very lucky to avoid it. I always considered myself a meteorological refugee. And I had a granny who was Polish, so I was very interested in that too. Anyway, will you join us downstairs for coffee? And may I just say, this is my last in this position. I've been sort of looking after these things for many years. But as you know, the Friends has been taken over by the museum, the administration thereof, and so it's up to the museum now to continue with Landmark Women, which they will next year. And Carice will be in touch with you by email and other means to tell you who are the speakers that are coming up. So thank you for attending. Bye bye. I forgot to ask for questions. Oh, come on back. Come on back. It was only when I saw this that I remembered I forgot to ask for questions. It's a good thing we're turning over to the museum. Questions.
That was a wonderful talk. Is that any better? Is that any better? Is that any better? I'll shout. That was a wonderful talk. Thank you so much. Given the importance of the spouse role you mentioned, mostly for your male colleagues, was that a lack for you that you didn't automatically have an offsider, or how did you handle that?
That's an interesting question. I, as a head of mission, I think it's an extra challenge not to have an enlightened husband, a wife there to sort of manage, because you do have to, although, you know, less and less, you know, entertainment is done in that official way now at home. But certainly, I mean, in Moscow I had a huge residence and I had four staff. And frankly, if I'd had a husband or a wife there organizing and making sure that everything was, it was a challenge, definitely, definitely. That's interesting too. I've noticed when I was in Poland, the British, who were very traditional in the way they conducted diplomacy, huge big residences. I used to envy my British colleague in Prague. She would always invite me for lunch, and she had a mansion. It was a palace. And she had two boys that went mostly at school in London. And she and her husband lived in this pokey part of... and they had a staff of, you know... But that suddenly the government said, we're selling it and we've got to totally reinvent the way we actually profile ourselves. And I think that's probably now, if you started, it wouldn't be so necessary to have a wonderful husband, house husband. Okay. Yes. Well, isn't it? It's very interesting. As I said, I spent almost a year in AusAid when it started going bigger. And I was sent across to help them sort of, you know, look at their structures and the way they conducted their relationship with their own people overseas, etc. And the assumption was that they'd get bigger and bigger, which they did for several years. I think it's tragic, frankly, the cut in AusAid. I mean, it was only to get us up to 0.5% of GDP, and the international sort of benchmark is 0.878. Yeah. You know, it's just, I just can't understand it. And, you know, particularly as it, from a diplomatic perspective, I mean, not only, but the dynamic of having a big, strong aid program at your post, just, I tell you, it gives you so much influence and leverage in a very positive way. So I'm not hopeful. I don't think it could possibly be happening in the near future. I mean, it was a dramatic shift. I have an AusAid colleague, was AusAid, here and many Aussie colleagues. It's just shocking, quite frankly. But one thing, I did a report after my year in AusAid, and I gave the report to Senator McMullen, who was the minister responsible for AusAid, and he invited me across to talk about it. And one of the issues I raised, and I think it's especially relevant now, is the different cultures between DFAT and AusAid, and the need to have much more interaction and much more dynamic interaction. Not in the way it's been done. It could be, but there needs to be much more interaction in a much more sensitive and the cultures have got to be taught to do that.
I think this works if you speak right into it.
Can I ask you where you were in the world? Were you in Australia or were you overseas when we had that dreadful incident called the Tampa affair, or the Tampa incident, the so-called children overboard? I personally was in the United Kingdom, and the flack that I received as an Australian from people who were so pro-Australian before that. Mm. I mean, the media overseas just hammered Australia.
When was that? Was it 2007, 6? Oh, God, 2001, yeah. No, I was in Moscow. And, no, it didn't get much coverage there.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Isn't it? But, yes.
Maybe it was just the UK making a huge thing of it.
Oh, no, I think it attracted, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's the racist and asylum and tamper and the whole thing, and it gets a lot of coverage in most of the informed world. Thank you.
What diplomatic options might be going on in Jakarta at the moment?
Ooh. Now, no, I wouldn't.
You know, not after solutions, but, you know, there are procedures and relationships that you have with governments, and somehow or other, you'd be calling on these in some way, but I don't know what they might be, and I'm just interested.
No, well, look, quite frankly, I'm right out of that. I went to Jakarta from AusAid, looking at the big aid program and how it fitted, you know, both in the embassy culture and in the local culture. But as you can imagine, I mean, Jakarta is one of our most important posts. I mean, it'd be up there in the top, definitely in the top five. And it's only just, not only just, it's becoming more and more comprehensive, and all those links are becoming more and more compelling and vital. So I can imagine it's just going to be a hugely complex, tense challenge for both sides.
A diplomatic.
Thank you very much, Ruth. That was a wonderfully interesting and inspirational talk. At the moment, women in leadership and women in power is an issue, particularly in the Australian landscape, with Australia's first female Prime Minister having just been, we've just seen that. And I'm interested in your insights, given that the groundbreaking work that you've done as a female ambassador, your insights into females in leadership roles and how it is, or the lessons that young women need to look at and consider.
Mm. Now that's a very I remember back about 20 years ago when there was a much more conscious effort to get more women into positions of influence in DFAT, in foreign affairs. We established a sort of a mentoring system. It didn't last very long, but it was a real, you know, so I think mentoring and linking and having role models, we don't have enough female role models in DFAT. And enough, the culture isn't getting out and sort of being, you know, a mentor and not just for women, but so that's very important to have examples, models that you can feel confident about, and to have obviously a head of department and his that do very, very directly identify this as a priority. When I went to the launch of Wives and Baggage to Follow, Peter Varghese, the secretary, made a point of bringing up the issue of women, not just, but not enough, 25% of our heads of mission are now women. So in 74, I looked after the first one, and what, nearly 40 years later, we're still only up to 25%. It's not good enough. But it's complex, it's complicated. I mean, a lot of women, I always remember when I was in the corporate management division, there was a study just released of small businesses. And this is back about 20 years ago, 30 years ago maybe, 20. No small business, medium small business, operated, owned by a woman had gone bankrupt. The turnover for the men was huge. And then they also noticed that no small, medium business operated, owned by a woman, got bigger. And they concluded that for two reasons. One, women weren't bold and daring and strategic enough. And I think that's part of our culture too. And we need more role models for that. But secondly, women chose not to. They preferred to have a balanced life. And I think that's also an issue, particularly for foreign affairs when, you know, as I said, with your travel and family. So, you know, it's a mix. But we do need more women up the top, definitely. Thank you.
Okay, who's for tea or coffee? Downstairs. Thank you. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.